Right, so I've been letting the requisite movie play in the background while you were all gathering, but you know, this is showing outflows from dwarf galaxies in this simulation, and so today I'll be focusing on the processes that drive those outflows and the fact that they also lead to dark matter core creation and the observational consequences of that as well. This makes it look much more formal than this is, so I consider this to be more of slides and less of a talk, slides to talk about, so I figure you guys will just interrupt me as is normally the case, but the outline, the general discussion outline, I guess will be, I'm going to review what leads to dark matter core creation in these galaxies. So for those of you who were here during the conference week, you probably would have seen Andrew Ponton's talk. It's going to be a recap of that, basically. How many people were not here actually during the conference? Okay. All right. So maybe it's useful to go through it anyway. And then I'll talk about the fact that this leads to dark matter core creation as a function of mass and the observational consequences of that. And then I'm actually going to make an appeal to some of the observers in the room or anybody who can help me get some more data to try to test these processes. So the code I use is called Gasoline. It is an N-body plus SPH code. It has all your standard bells and whistles. It is fully cosmological, so it turns on at redshift of about 100, run all my galaxies to redshift 0. So it has a uniform UV background that turns on at redshift 9, and that's intended to mimic reionization. It starts off initially gas and dark matter, and you let gravity do its thing, and the gas wants to cool in the galaxies and go on to form stars. Each of those star particles is born as a single stellar population with the Kupa IMF. And then the massive stars in that star particle have to eventually go supernova. And they do that, the feedback mechanism for that is what we've termed our blast wave model. And this is because it's based on the blast wave solution for a supernova remnant. In other words, it actually follows the Taylor solution. For every supernova that goes off, you calculate, based on the surrounding pressure in the ISM, the radius that should be affected. And then, of course, for any given supernova that's really, really tiny, like, you know, a parsec, which we don't resolve, but multiple go off together, so they actually add together to create a larger blast wave radius that we do resolve.
And then they have to go off almost simultaneously.
So well, within a time step, right, that you calculate, so there are multiple that go off together.
But these blast waves don't destroy each other. I mean, if they don't go off simultaneously, right, I mean, you don't really get...
Right, and you don't get them adding together. Yeah, no, this is true.
So do you have POP 3 stars, or do you have some sort of base?
It's always Kupa. Yep. Everything starts off metal-free, and the first stars that go off are Kupa.
Okay. This is just regular Schmidt kind of star formation law so far, right?
Yep, exactly.
So it's not metal-free.
Yep. The energy from those supernovae is injected as thermal energy only. There are no momentum kicks given to the surrounding ISM. And we do turn off the cooling in the radius that should be affected, and that's to try to mimic the adiabatic expansion phase of that supernova remnant, and so you turn off cooling for about the period of time that corresponds to that phase as well. And so I don't believe I included a photo of it or an image from the simulations here today, but you can see often that you get these holes in the ISM of H1 bubbles, and they look very similar to the holes you see in H1 in local. Yes, well, I suppose they would be, but when I make an H1 map, they look like dark holes. Yes, yeah. But they look like, you know, H1 maps of local group dwarf galaxies, which I find very encouraging. So. All of the runs that I'm going to be showing you today have force resolutions of 50 to 150 parsecs. So it says here this resolves star-forming regions, and what I mean is things that look like giant molecular clouds, and I'll be talking more about that on the next slide. The star particles are born with masses of 1,000 to 10,000 solar masses, depending on what blocks they're being pulled from. The gas has both, you know, your standard primordial cooling, hydrogen and helium, and also metal line cooling, and now an additional cooling of a molecular phase. And H2-based star formation. For every gas particle in the simulation, we're now calculating the creation and destruction rates for molecular gas. And then you can say, I will only allow star formation to occur where there is molecular gas.
Gas phase or
There's a, well, based on the metallicity, there's some prescription for dust as a catalyst to look at
So the rate of H2 formation, is the one that is relative to the formation of dust or of gas phase?
Oh, I see. There's both. So at high redshift, right, the gas phase one comes in, and at low redshift, where there's actually metals, then you have the dust phase one, yep.
I apologize to ask this again, but how do you cool the, I don't understand how you don't get pop three stars. What is the cooling?
Yeah. When gas becomes cold and dense enough to form a star particle, it's just born with the Kupa IMF.
Okay.
So I never say that there are some massive stars that form.
What's a dark matter particle?
Because there's no evidence for them, right?
So but because you have a primordial chain for H2.
Exactly, it can happen.
In some sense, pop three stars, they're just not. They just don't have
any. Right, matter. As in they form from primordial gas, therefore, yes.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
What's your dark matter particle mass?
I mean, probably about an order of magnitude higher than that. Right?
Yeah, so I mean, pop 3 star formation occurs in like 10 to the 6 solar mass halos, so that you're probably not really resolving those. So
I'm definitely not resolving, star formation really in 10 to the 6 halos.
You might be forming these pop 3 stars in larger halos because you can
have yes.
But there, you don't have to rely on H2 cooling anyways, you can just do it with atomic cooling. So the whole,
Or gas phase.
Sorry, I'm again observers. Speak slowly. But your first stars to form are forming from non-enriched material.
Correct.
So therefore, by my definition, all three.
Okay.
They just don't have an unusual IMF.
They don't have an unusual IMF. That's all I meant. Yeah.
Yeah. But
right.
You can know nothing about all three stars.
Exactly. So, which is why I don't want to put it in there. Yeah. But yeah, to address 10 to the 6 mini halos, I mean, right, I only trust things above a certain mass resolution anyway. When a certain number of particles clump together, I would actually trust the mass resolution, say at a couple hundreds of particles, which means that you have to, there's a lower threshold of a galaxy, what I would call a galaxy in which stars can form anyway, and it definitely wouldn't be a mini halo.
And then you follow the metals, but you just follow metals as metals?
Oxygen and iron and total metal. Yeah.
So for the H2 formation, you use something like compounds, or do you follow?
It's actually, it's more like Nick Ganem's scheme, yeah. All right. So all the galaxies I'll show you here today have, I think, all of the main galaxies that I follow will have more than 10 million particles within the Vero radius, Vero redshift zero. And when I say main, what I mean is, right, I am putting very, very high resolution on one given galaxy in a large volume. Now, that usually means I buffer that out to a few times the Vero radius of that galaxy, and so I get a bonus few extra field galaxies in that volume as well. And those will be, by definition, not quite as resolved, but they should still have thousands or millions of particles in them.
And how do you decide which object that you focus on in that volume?
The initial conditions for these were all sort of selected years ago, and the idea was to, you start with a dark matter only box, and then say I want to look at Milky Way mass galaxies. The idea was to select a range of merger histories and spin values, so not to try to stick to the conventional quiescent merger history and large spin value thing that might give you a Milky Way, and then you just do that as a function of mass. Okay. So I like to show this slide because it's my attempt to explain to you why I now get outflows in these simulations and people didn't get outflows before without adding some sort of momentum kick. So what you're looking at in both of these plots is the density of gas particles in a galaxy as a function of radius. Okay, and this case on the right here is meant to demonstrate the case that that we sort of had historically. Right, so you can imagine that historically we didn't have as good computational efficiency as we do now. Your force resolutions were lower. And so let's say that your force resolution was something like half a kiloparsec in a box. Well, we know that star formation is happening on scales much, much smaller than half a kiloparsec, right? But you can't resolve that. You can't resolve the high density peaks where star formation is actually occurring, which means to get star formation to happen at all, you have to lower your density threshold for star formation. Okay, and this is the value, this red line is a value that has sort of been universally adopted by almost every simulation group, and it's 0.1 atoms per cubic centimeter.
Happens to know what that is in like solar masses per...
Not off the top of my head, but somebody else here might. Not off the top of my head, does anybody else?
Right.
So what do you want to know?
Well, I mean, we know observationally about what that...
Surface density.
Oh, surface density.
Yeah, surface density.
But this is Well, this is the number then.
Right, this is volume. Well, let's put it this way. Even in this case, you still have the fall in the Kennicott Schmidt law, right? So you were reaching those surface densities, if that's what you're asking.
So with your higher star formation efficiency.
Let me get there. Okay. All right. So, right. You can see that in this case, what you've got now is all of these gas particles are eligible to go on and form star particles, right? So you can get the sort of diffuse star formation across your entire disk. Now we're in a regime where we're getting to much higher force resolution, and now you can see that we're starting to resolve these high-density peaks where star formation can actually occur. Okay, so this is a simulation that has about 85 parsec force resolution. And you can see now that we've got hundreds of gas particles clumping together. They look more like giant molecular clouds. The sizes and masses comparable to giant molecular clouds. So we can make them act a little bit more like giant molecular clouds, and we can set a more realistic star formation threshold. Right, so I've drawn up here 100 atoms per cc, but in reality, when you go to the H2-based star formation, you don't even need a density threshold anymore, because now, by saying that your stars have to form in molecular gas, you naturally have to form stars above this threshold.
So just to backtrack a little bit, so this is three orders of magnitude suddenly difference in this threshold. So that minus one is historically being set because you say, okay, I need that density, but I have this ball of resolution, let's smear it out, and that lowers everything to this like minus one in log density. And that's why people chose it, or was it just like they'll choose something?
No, it's a match to get you basically, you know, the sizes of galaxies that look best, and
but this is just a complete tuning parameter that people set in order to make these galaxies look anything.
Sure, but you can automatically see, right? So this is a dwarf galaxy, right? But if I were to change the threshold up here, I then would truncate all of my disks, right? You would get things that don't look like realistic galaxies. So it was set.
You just get no star formation.
You just get no star formation, yeah. Well, you would, but you would get all bulges, you know? So, right, so it's set to actually give you disks, basically. And now what I'm saying is you don't need that anymore. All right, but now you can see that across your disk, you now just get star formation in these high-density peaks that sort of stochastically pop up. So you dramatically reduce the amount of stars that form overall in this galaxy. And Mike, I think that's what you're getting at. So, all right, so you're cutting back on the amount of star formation, which means that in order to match the normalization of the Kennicott-Schmidt law, you have to increase the efficiency of star formation. And what I mean by that is over here, if you were a gas particle and you were cold and dense enough to go on to form a star particle, there's a 5% chance that you will do so. And over here, there's now a 10% chance that you'll do so. Okay.
Just a factor of two.
Yeah, that's it.
And that number is chosen because you're trying to match the star.
The normalization of the Kennicott-Schmidt law. Yep.
But it's still worth pointing out that in actual molecular clouds, with those scales, you have a star formation efficiency of 1%.
Yes, but if you then go to the simulation and average over a region where stars are forming, you do not get 10% out. You do not get 10% star formation efficiency in that gas, because when the supernovas start to go off, they shut off the star formation in the surrounding gas particles. So that should not be translated directly into an observable.
So if you take, I mean, what's the amount of gas? Because, I mean, this is a logarithmic scale, right? So there's a huge amount of gas in a few of these peaks compared to the rest, right? That's why you have this factor of two. You
right.
Do it with the factor of two, even though you put your scale of three orders of magnitude higher.
Yep, good point. And this is also why the feedback now becomes more efficient, right? So now you're forming stars at a higher efficiency in these tight density peaks, and now when the supernova goes off, it deposits more energy into more mass than it ever used to before. And now, you can drive outflows.
Can you say that sentence one more time?
Yeah. It's basically, right, so you're denser than you ever have been, but you're forming more stars than you were before. So now it's literally the energy per unit mass is higher than it was in the past. And so you can drive the outflows from the galaxy that you couldn't before. All right, so there is, in fact.
I can ask another question. So that means that the molecular mass that you have is roughly half of the total mass of the galaxy.
No.
Because the efficiency is doubled, right?
Right.
So that means if you have the same number of stars, doesn't mean that now you have roughly the same amount of molecular energy.
No, definitely not. No, the molecular fractions in like something like this is a dwarf galaxy, right? They're like 8%. You know?
Then I don't understand why it's just a factor of two changing the efficiency.
All right. Well, okay, so actually, and it's, to be fair, the efficiency changes with the molecular law, and it is a function of the amount of H2 that's present. Yeah, sorry. There you go.
Presumably, there's a parameter that you use in your code, which is sort of the efficiency of making stars out of gas that satisfies certain criteria. And that has to be the same as proportional. Right? You can't tune that for
it's proportional to the fraction of H2 that's present in this case.
No, we should have an efficiency which is now defined in terms of the fraction.
And that number is constant. That number is constant, but now it's multiplied by.
And of course, it's that's a function of the fraction of H2 if you do it over the gas.
Yes. Okay. Fair enough.
Sorry, another observer question. I'm still trying to understand the improved force resolution.
Yes.
Is that just like Moore's law? Like it's just
yeah.
better. And is there some force resolution that's actually interesting below which?
Oh well.
Uninteresting.
Well, you've asked a very philosophical question, but basically, as you push down the. As we go to, this is kind of a sweet spot, I would actually say, because when you go to higher resolutions, right, you're going to start to get to a point where you're resolving the effects of supernovae, individual supernovae, at some point. And then you basically have to change everything you're doing, because right now this is all subgrid physics, right? Star formation and feedback is all subgrid, and then you have to start paying attention to what's really happening, right? So.
You have to put in
magnetic
field.
Yeah, radiation pressure, which is really not in here, right? It's sort of mimicked by the thermal feedback.
I don't know, like historical purposes. The fact that you guys decided to look at dwarf galaxies was kind of an interesting step, like as sort of a bonus extra force resolution by going to smaller galaxies.
Yes, it's true.
I thought that was really
right. So, they're drawn from a smaller box, therefore you can get to twice as much force resolution. Yeah, it's true. Works out well for it. Yeah. All right, so this movie that's been playing, there is a dwarf galaxy, so something that's about a few times 10 to the 10 in virial mass sitting at the center here, and it is oriented disk edge on, but the disk, of course, in this case is like a couple kiloparsecs, so you can't even really see it here. But what you can see, this is just a temperature map, so this is chosen to show you outflows from this galaxy at this particular redshift. And the black circle is the virial radius of this galaxy at this redshift. So you can see that these outflows, like, this is not just a little galactic fountain. These things are actually being ejected from the galaxy.
How much mass is actually going out?
Let's come back to that in a moment, actually.
What are the units on the box?
Which?
That's kiloparsecs.
Kiloparsecs, yeah.
And the black circle is the virial radius?
Yeah, roughly.
Okay. So the virial radius is like 50 kiloparsecs, so that's a lot smaller than the molecular.
At redshift of the, yes it is. Yeah, this is sort of SMC-ish, right? Yeah. All right, Josh, your question. There was a discussion 2 weeks ago when both Nick and Stacy were still here about the baryonic Kelly-Fisher relationship. And basically, you know, Stacy pointed out that there was a nice trend. So he had dynamical mass probably versus this, the baryon, detectable baryon fraction, right, times the cosmic baryon, what you would expect to be in this galaxy if it was at the cosmic abundance. And he pointed out that there was this nice trend in galaxy mass, and he had this clump of galaxies down here about 10 to the minus 4. And Nick made the point that, in fact, probably much of that gas in a given halo is hiding in a hot phase that's just undetected because of reionization heating up that gas. So I said that day that I would make this plot, and I have showed this to both Nick and Stacy before they left, but I thought maybe I would follow up with everybody else who was here. What you're seeing in black is the baryon fraction in my simulations if I just take everything within the virial radius of that galaxy. So I can count up all the hot gas, stars, and the dark matter. And then I can also do it again, and I can say what is the cold fraction, or the amount of cold gas, neutral gas, and molecular gas, and I've multiplied it by 1.4 as an observer might, to get you helium, and added it to the stellar mass. And if I do that, I get the red points. Right, so you can see that, yes, there's actually quite a bit of hot gas hiding in these galaxies, but there's also, you know, a fair amount of gas that's been lost as well from these galaxies.
What are the open points?
The open points are same thing, but they are the ones that would not have any detectable cold gas in them. So stars, they would, but not gas.
So this predicts that the Milky Way has a hot halo that's essentially baryonically closed, or almost.
Almost. Well, it's there's a log plot, right? So it looks like 80% or so.
But even at 20 kilometers per second, you're predicting an order of magnitude more hot stuff than in the cold gas plus stars.
Say that one more time. Where am I looking?
At 20 kilometers
per second. Yes. Yeah. Well, and even these things. So you see these things, this black circle and these red circles, they would not look like they had any detectable gas, but they do, right? That's why there's this offset in these. There's actually hot gas in those things.
How hot is the gas?
It's like 10 to the 4. Didn't I have this?
It's not detectable.
Yeah, in H1.
It's not the gas that we're seeing outflowing in the previous.
No.
So in the disk.
No, it's within the Vero radius.
it's the stuff that
I understand.
But before, we were seeing that it's mostly that. We can go back to the movie again before. So that is mostly hot, right? See that?
Well, this stuff is at like a million Kelvin. But look at all this stuff too, right? This is all not. This isn't detectable either.
Thermal emission in the radio. I mean, that is detectable.
This is your gas in falling onto a galaxy. There's nobody's detected it yet.
If every galaxy has a halo filled with hot ionized gas,
people have been looking for it.
But this stuff shouldn't even be ionized if it's at 10 to the 4.
Yeah, that's why it's called gas. you should be able to detect it now. I mean, quite easily. If you take a sample of galaxies, you stack them up, you will start to see a signal in thermal pre-free emission. If this really goes to one, you get a very strong thermal emission in the radio. With current EVLA or even, you can go down to microgen speed.
But this stuff appears like a million degrees.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, just below two.
It's quarter decay EVLA emission. It seems X-rays of that temperatures.
Yeah.
Well, just below, if it's just below, let's say, 500,000 Kelvin, it's thermal emission.
That would be essentially a chopper, right?
Yeah, I'm not the first person to predict that.
It's H-O.
That's
why it's
circle
binding is making
that H-O. Yeah. There is no H-O. So it depends where that gas is. If you just kind of blow it out all the way over the Fourier radius.
This is inside here.
Yeah.
What is the density distribution of that hot gas?
Oh, boy. No, off the top of my head, but it's not high. It's exactly. But yeah, it's really low density, right? It's like IGM. It is IGM.
But then back in the Castro, have detected localized oxygen 6 oxygen.
Yes.
Around Milky Way, which they
show. Yes. Right. But there's another complication, which is when you see metals in these sight lines. You still don't know how much mass is actually there, right? What if it's just like an ejecta blob and there's really not like
and for the,
that's preferentially metal enriched and you don't know how much entrainment is there. So
for the Milky Way stuff, you don't actually know where it is. It could be very close.
Yeah, no, exactly.
Except if you look on the LMC sight line, then you actually have a distance control.
So I wasn't here for Stacy's when he was here. Is this a fair comparison? Can he actually? Does he actually have a census out to the Vero radius? He's presumably only.
No. Right. He's talking about detectable.
Within the dynamical the radius. So this is not really this comparison doesn't.
Like this.
No, but that's the point of the red, is to be fair. Is to be fair to stasis comparisons.
I'm still not, maybe I'm misunderstanding, but that includes all the material even within the Vero radius.
No, well, stars, but in terms of cold gas, that's only in the disk.
Like cold inflows and stuff like that.
No, that stuff's not in H1.
Okay. So I guess I should look at the red
stuff. I know about cold flows, that stuff's not in H1.
So I should look at the red stuff as being everything
in the disk.
You would be able
yes,
to
see. Correct, yeah.
In fact, some of your
missing stuff is probably in cold flows, right?
Yeah.
So ionized 10 to 4 filaments.
Cold flows. Now we see the problem with the word cold flows. Yeah.
So I'm not, when I do some plot like this, I always see a scatter, and I don't see a dependence with mass on the x-axis.
Right.
So it's a scatter and it's sort of horizontal across. There isn't a function of mass. The barren part is not a real function of mass.
You don't say this is a trend?
I see that as a trend right now, but okay. In the observations?
Stacy's whole point was that this is a very tight trend, but I know that you've said that Stacy's selecting his galaxies to be not fall on a nice tight trend.
You're saying you see a bigger scatter?
Yeah.
And that there isn't a super crazy clear trend with mass.
Well,
I think he selects his galaxies.
But you see a big scatter
above 30 kilometers a second. I'm saying that below 30 kilometers, things are incredibly scattered, in part because I don't think we have a lot of things that are truly isolated.
But that may be part of what is happening.
Yeah. I would say the scatter gets larger here, but I don't. Yeah. It's not enough points for me to say that.
No, I know. I'm just saying that clear trend with mass in the observations, I'm dubious of the clear trend with mass.
Okay. Well,
so these three galaxies are under the minus 2, they also have stars.
Yeah.
And what's the stellar mass?
Ooh, it's got to be like 10 to the 5.
Yeah. And those are all in isolation?
Yeah. Yeah, so I've purposely not put satellites on here. I actually did originally plot the satellites on here, and they follow a nice trend. The problem is this right here, MVIR, is not well-defined for satellites. And so I've just naively taken this from my Halo Finder, and I can't believe that value for satellites. So I just took them off this plot because they follow a nice trend, but they tended to be, you know, like above all this because I had a bad value of MVIR.
So if you go down to 10 kilometers a second, do you not form a galaxy?
Right, correct. I get empty halos.
Is that polarization?
Yep.
Yeah.
And to follow up on it, you mentioned gas fractions in your talk on Tuesday, so I thought I'd again take it for the red points and show you what the gas fractions would be. So this is the cold gas in this galaxy over the total observable baryonic mass.
It's H1 plus H2.
Correct.
But those guys have almost no H2. Yes, the little one.
Right. Oh yeah. But you can see here's some scatter, right? This is, I mean, there's a clear lack of these.
That's really nice.
Yeah, yeah. But you can see the scatter does increase towards these lower masses.
Do those gas fractions
seem
low?
They do.
Yeah.
In which one, the high mass galaxies or the?
Low mass. Like, so the fact that the scatter
even when they're like 90%.
Well,
you just mean the fact that there's a...
Your mean is 50%.
Yeah,
so you're plotting
enough.
In log. If you plot that in linear, it would be... If I plot mine in Mott log, most of them will be above half a gas
fraction. Okay. Okay. Right, so that might still be...
Isolated things.
Yeah, that might be a nice constraint, though. Mm-hmm. All right, and my last bit on this. When we were at the coffee discussion 2 weeks ago, I said that the baryonic-Tully Fisher relationship did nothing for me in terms of discerning models.
And I wanted to
show what I meant by that, right? So what you're seeing in here, the blue points are Stacy's data. The diamonds are simulations that have only primordial cooling, right? Hydrogen, helium, that's it. And then the squares have added an additional metal line cooling on top. And then the red is the H2-based, or the H2 cooling plus H2-based star formation. And what you can see is all of those models fall nicely along the baryonic-Tully Fisher relationship. Right? So they don't tell me anything about the physics of how that gas got into the galaxy. However, if I look at other properties of the galaxies, there's a dramatic difference, right? So this is the rotation curve. This is for the metal line cooling alone, right? So let me start with the dotted line, which is the primordial gas cooling, which is something like the Eris run would have had. And then if you would have added metal lines to that, you would have ended up with a whole lot more cooling onto the central disk and a huge bulge. And then if you take that same metal line cooling but then add this additional molecular gas and molecular-based star formation, you start driving outflows from the central regions of your galaxy and preferentially removing the low angular momentum gas that goes into big bulges, and you get this red rotation curve instead. And this is the result on the density profiles.
Okay.
for the dark matter in these galaxies.
But for a particular mass object, does it change? Does that behavior change dramatically?
Somewhat. So this is for something that's a few times 10 to the 11. In the few times 10 to the 10 galaxy, you do not get quite as dramatic a bulge. Right, so in that case, it's still clumpy star formation and you still get some ejecta. And so they're not, this is not quite as dramatic. But.
So you can get clumpy star formation either with a high density threshold or by turning on the molecular cooling. It's sort of the same. So how come the black line, I mean, presumably that run also had a high threshold. It just didn't have anything to do with molecular chemistry. So why didn't it also have really?
Yeah, it clearly has clumpy star formation, but I mean, all of these do, right? So you can see, though, that this has clumpy star formation, and you still get out a nice rotation curve, right? But it really is the additional cooling onto it. You can't keep up with the excess cooling onto the central regions.
It just wasn't doing any cooling. It's not the metal line gets you down to 200 Kelvin.
We still are having this argument. You need to talk to Charlotte. We get extra cooling from our H2. So
I mean, the physics.
No, in your model, but in our models, we get some cooling.
Model, just in calculations. H2 doesn't do any cooling.
In the disk, it is. And you're not including it. In the disk it is, which means you can, you know, have more fragmentation, more star formation happening.
What do you mean by in the disk?
When it actually cools, into the disk and is capable of going on forming stars, the molecular cooling in that component has an additional, allows you to fragment even more than the other two cases do, which means that you have more star formation and you have more of this ejecta.
But that cooling is being done in the molecular gas, but is not actually related to H2.
It's not the H2 molecules that are the main cooler.
Oh, sorry. No, sorry. Yeah.
I think that's what
speaking about it in terms of models. I think so. Yeah.
Right, but that would be captured by the metal cooling too, right?
No, that's what I'm saying. You don't get much fragmentation and star formation in the disk.
I guess I don't understand like what is producing the cooling. I mean, if you're saying you have an H2 cooling curve, then that doesn't make any sense. If you have some kind of additional prescription for gas cooling, like based on CO or something like that.
Yes.
But that's not.
Or
I guess what's happening is that when you have H2 cooling, then you allow the temperature to go very low, below 200, so you can go down to 10. That increases the density. And therefore, it boosts the star formation rate.
I guess that's what I'm not getting. I think even with 200 Kelvin, you should get a lot of dense gas.
Yeah, you have an extra boost when you go from 200 to 10, right? So your temperature, so your density.
But all you need to get is above the threshold, right? So.
But other gases should be below 200. So suppose you have a partial gas which has 200K and it's below the threshold, then you.
But that doesn't exist. I think if it's a 200 Kelvin, it's also going to be above the density threshold.
All right. Well, you and I should talk about this further then, because we clearly.
You could adjust your threshold with the metal dependent case to get back.
Oh, yeah. You certainly could, yeah.
It makes sense that you can't use the same one that you were using before.
The same one, the same prescription?
Value, threshold value. Is that what you mean by showing that comparison, that goes with the same threshold?
So we already said the molecular has a slightly different definition of the threshold value, right? Because it's based on its some efficiency times the molecular fraction, right? Whereas these are just straight up efficiency.
Right.
Yeah. So it's different. It is not sure.
The star formation is coupled to the total gas density in the black one and to the H2 density in the red one.
Correct.
But at these densities, they're the same. It's 100% the molecular fraction.
No, not in a galaxy.
No.
At 50 kilometers per second.
I mean, with like 10 to the minus 2 solar and a density of, you know, hundreds of particles.
Yeah, it is in your run. You have this uniform star formation no matter what. Once you get to this molecular floor, this metallurgy floor.
I'm not talking about any runs. It's just like analytically. You can just look at it like analytical calculations.
Yeah, fine. I'm telling you exactly what is happening in these runs, though, is that we're getting extra fragmentation, extra star formation, more outputs.
I don't understand.
Okay, well, let's talk about it later rather than dragging everybody else into it.
Fair enough.
All right. Now I'm finally, okay, half an hour in, I'm finally getting to the point of this talk, which is dark matter corporation. Okay, and so this is a density profile for that same dwarf galaxy I showed you earlier with the outputs. And you can see that as it comes around here to high redshift, that it does not start off with a dark matter core, right? Its density profile is actually initially cuspy, it's consistent with NFW, and it's only over time that this thing flattens into a chord profile. And the reason that's happening in these simulations is, again, because we are now capturing these high densities. So when you can see these higher gas densities, in this run, we can now see that the gas and dark matter densities at the very central regions are comparable. And that's actually very important, because when this happens, what you're seeing here is just a gas density map right after a burst of star formation and some supernovae have gone off, and they've created one of these hot bubbles of gas. Now, because the densities are comparable, this hot bubble of gas wants to rapidly expand. And it's not an adiabatic process, it's impulsive. And so it expands and it flattens the potential. And basically, since those densities are comparable, the dark matter has no choice. It's got to come along for the ride, and the orbits expand for the dark matter.
So do you not see any adiabatic contraction in the pre-blowout phase? Like you say, start with
NFW. Yeah, you can. I hesitate to answer that because I've looked at this in all of a couple of galaxies, and I don't want to say anything. Let me put it this way. I was looking at it this morning, and sometimes you get adiabatic contraction sometimes, and this is at, you know, a specific redshift. It's not quantifiable yet, but like sometimes it's lower, you know, it's already, this process already happening. Sometimes you have adiabatic contraction. It's not consistent. I don't have an answer for you yet.
One question is, how fast does the gas flow in with respect to the free fall time? Like, what's essentially the doubling time for the mass?
Well, I mean, in these galaxies, the cooling time is much shorter than the free fall time, right? So you have to fall in on the free fall time.
Okay. So it's not going to be, I mean, there will still be some compression, but it won't be like
that. Well, that's in the halo, though.
In the dynamic hole.
That's a different story altogether in the disk. I was talking about the halo when I was talking about, well, either way, the cooling times are going to be very, very fast here in the disk, right? And I don't know what the dynamical time is there. Probably figured it out, but.
I guess that the question is, the real comparison between the rate at which the gas is flowing out to the infrared, or free fall time, and the crossing time of the bubble out of the radio radius.
Mm-hmm. It doesn't go. No, okay, so what's happening here, right, this is not a uniform bubble that expands out of the virial radius, right? This bubble expands, and then as it expands, right, so this is looking face on, right? So the top edges of this break out perpendicular disk, and that's the stuff that flows out.
The velocities that you measure, I think, the bubble, what I mean, in the second.
Yes, yeah, sure, yeah.
So at this mass, 7 years to get out of the virial radius of the parsec. So free fall time is it longer or is it shorter?
10^7 in this mass galaxy.
This is the comparison to, you know, if you can remove the gas before.
Probably you, longer, yeah.
Well, free fall time is like 10, more like 10^8.
Yeah, that's. I would definitely say it's longer than 7.
If it is short, it's all right, because you know, you want to remove the gas before the
dark matter ends.
You know what happens with the stars as well? You showed it.
Yes, let me get to that in a moment. Okay. All right, so there you go. Dark matter core creation.
So the disk is going like this?
Yeah, we're looking at it.
And it's blowing out.
Yeah, we're looking at face on. Yeah, so the outflows are coming towards you.
Got it.
Yeah.
Sorry, I think the time scale that you want is not the dynamical time versus how fast it gets out to the virial radius, but how fast it gets out to just the few kilograms.
Yeah,
you don't care
about
that way.
That should be much shorter than the dynamic.
Even, yeah.
It
is.
But then the gas recollapses, right?
It does, and that's an adiabatic process, though.
That's adiabatic?
Yeah, like when this stuff all wants to cool again onto it, that's adiabatic.
Okay.
Oh, sorry.
Adiabatic in the sense of adiabatic.
Yeah. Dynamically,
just
mean yeah.
That adiabatic invariant is conserved.
Yeah. Okay. Now, if this happens once, you do not get a core. Okay. You have to do this over and over again. You have to have a bursty star formation and do this over and over to keep flattening your density profile and get a core profile out. Okay. Now,
because
the contraction is adiabatic, and so you have to, in order to undo that.
Well, Mike, you've done this calculation. Just if you, even if you unbind all of the gas from the galaxy in a single go, there's not enough.
Right.
There's not enough, a big enough change in the binding energy, right, to flatten the density significantly.
Is the flattening really occurring because of some sort of inverse adiabatic contraction, like adiabatic expansion, or is it because you're doing it asymmetrically, right? I mean, your star is going off here, so actually what you're doing is sloshing the halo around, right, and sort of heating it
up. But it's like a lossy heat engine, basically.
Sorry?
It's like a lossy heat engine. Mm-hmm. It's not a reversible process.
Right.
I guess
that's exactly right. It's not a reversible process. Yeah.
So I thought of this. I changed the way I thought about this after Andrew's talk.
Okay.
It's an impulse approximation, right?
Like yes.
You change the potential really quick,
yes.
And then everything else is there. You add energy or gains energy.
Sure. In the orbits, yeah.
In the orbits, yeah.
Yep. That's exactly right. Yeah. Okay. Now, turns out, all right, so star formation, and in particular bursty star formation, at least in these simulations, varies as a function of mass. So there's sort of the sweet spot somewhere around roughly 10 to the 8, maybe 10 to the 9, where you have a very bursty star formation history, and so you keep undergoing this repeated dark matter quarter, or this repeated flattening, so that you get down to even, you know, alpha of 0 in the slope. But as you get onto these lower mass galaxies, you don't undergo these repeated bursts of star formation. So particularly down here, you can imagine these are the things that are like affected by reionization, right? They may undergo a single burst of star formation and they never do again. And so they actually end up maintaining their NFW profiles as opposed to being cored.
So tell me about this point, it's by 10 to the 10, which is also down to that, just in your simulation.
Oh crap, this is an old plot. this exactly. is undergoing a merger, and therefore it's dense, because it's having a whole bunch of stuff driven to the center.
Okay, so normally everything...
So ignore that.
Sure.
Yeah. So if you look at the final paper, that's... Anyway, yeah, no, that's not an isolated galaxy. Let's put it that way. Right, so what you're seeing on here in blue are the things, galaxy sample, you can see that in the range of overlap, they nicely, or the simulations are very comparable to the slopes we measured in the thing sample. And the black line shows you what you get if these things had stayed cuspy, if they'd stayed NFW.
Do you have like the plots of the star formation histories of those galaxies?
So this is just a sample. It's not all of them, but I thought somebody might ask me that question, and this is something that's like never in our talk.
So
yeah. Thank you, plant. All right. So this is a snapshot at redshift 3 of a couple of different mass galaxies that eventually become satellites. So soon I'm getting to the satellites as well. Where you know this is 3 times 10 to the 9, 2 times 10 to the 9, and 1.5 times 10 to the 9. And even though they're in virial mass, and so even though they're not hugely different in virial mass, you can see that this one at 3 times 10 to the 9 has a really bursty star formation history, and these other ones down here don't seem to undergo as dramatic a change. Now we're working on trying to quantify that in some way, but I don't have a really good...
It's my totally predictable question.
Yeah.
Do they ever go to zero?
Yeah.
They do go to zero.
Do some of these things stop forming stars? Yes, particularly satellites.
While they still have gas.
Oh.
Do they have gas and not forming stars?
I haven't seen a case like that. Yes.
Which would basically mean you can't form any molecular hydrogen.
Right.
But you have a pure
right.
neutral...
I haven't looked for it, but I off the top of my head, I don't know. All right. Now, so that was my exchange into the satellites. So all of that work has been done to date on field galaxies and simulations, right? Isolated galaxies. And with the Dzhokhov, I'm now looking at the impact that it has on the satellite galaxies. So what you're seeing here is the same galaxy. This thing has a virial mass of about 8 times 10 to the 11 in halo mass. So it's also very comparable to like what Carlos and Amina would say was the best fit for the Milky Way data in terms of matching the dwarf spheroidal data. All right, so this is the dark matter only case, and you can see that, yes, the rotation curves of the satellites that you get out in this particular simulation don't really seem to have any problem matching the Milky Way data. But if you go and then add gas to the run, these are the rotation curves of the satellites that you get out at redshift zero, and you can see there's a huge difference. All right?
Still no problem.
No problem. But the problem, right, the problem was that, right, with in Mike's Aquarius runs is that they were all like way too high. Yeah.
So wait, wasn't that for the smallest one you didn't really see an effect because they didn't have the burst feeling stuff?
Yeah, so if you dice this up a little bit closer, what you see is these are, well, let's start with the most luminous satellites at redshift zero, and then their dark matter only counterparts are shown by the blue dashed line. And you can see that they maintain a cuspy profile, and the density slopes in the massive galaxies at redshift zero are significantly flattened, and this is because they're undergoing core creation before they actually fall into the galaxy.
Your force resolution here is 150 or...
Yeah. And so that...
You have like only a few hundred dark matter particles in the inner...
But I can... Well, do you want me to... I know. This is... I can't play it. Because it's hidden. This is a convergence plot. So the black line is the resolution I'm looking at. This is the same run at a resolution that's got a 1.5 times larger force resolution. And you can see the density profiles do converge out at about 700 parsecs. Okay, so we go back to these plots. I mean, 700 parsecs is here, but there's still this major difference in the runs, even where I trust the convergence.
If you under-resolve the density structure, then you will...
But then how do you explain that when you go to the least massive satellites that have even fewer particles, this doesn't happen? They actually...
Because you're not forming as many stars there, right? So you don't have any... You don't have
any flattening.
Right, because you don't have any stars to pump energy into any of this.
Well, you've got stars. Look, you can take these same runs and add baryons to them and just change the star formation prescription, right? This was in the original Nature paper. And you don't get this happening, right? You still have as many stars and baryons in the center to scatter off of, but you still maintain a cuspy profile.
Depending on how you form the stars.
Yeah. So what I'm saying is not baryon. It's not scattering off of baryons. That's not a resolution thing.
So how bright are these ones and how faint are
they? These are. In terms of stellar mass, roughly about 10 to the 8.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and these are about a few times 10 to the 5.
So those are sort of classical.
Well, are they all?
10 to the 8 is SMC.
Okay.
And to be clear, I also did not make any cut on Magellanic type things like you did. If I did, one galaxy would be cut out of this plot. But you know, I mean, core creation happens in the gassy things too, so I just left everything in. Some of these have gas, some of them don't.
With Mike has a problem for all of the dwarfs, right? The faint ones too, these ones.
Yeah, I mean, most of them are 10 to the 5,
right.
Between 10 to the 5 and 10 to the 6 in stellar mass, not 10 to the 8.
I don't understand what you're saying. Why doesn't it?
So, because the change in the circular velocity that we need to bring into agreement the data that might...
Oh, sure. Because it's a lower mass galaxy, you mean?
Exactly, because this mechanism works for SMCs, but not for all the dwarf galaxies.
But it doesn't have to. In Mike's galaxy, it was only the more massive ones that were discrepant.
No. It's whatever the host of the dwarf spheroidals are the ones that are discrepant.
Yeah, the things that I say. So if these are classical, then they're too massive. Fine. You know, I don't care. Like, this is not a response to you, Mike. This is me saying the more massive luminous satellites in the Milky Way might be cored. Okay.
Yeah.
This is all I'm saying. Okay. And if they are, right, you can't use the mass of these satellites to tell you anything about the mass of the Milky Way because you should then scale it up.
So can we flip the prediction around? So what you're saying is the least luminous ones, even in the Milky Way, should have cores.
Yeah.
Or the cusps.
The cusps. Yeah. 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 Yep.
And can we tell whether?
Oh wow.
No.
They'll know.
No.
That's kind of prediction.
I mean, even with 2,000 stars in the classical ones, you really can't tell the difference between a core and a cusp. With 20 stars, we've done nothing. But with proper internal proper motions, then we can start playing this game. That'll happen in like 10 years.
On the right, are those the same payloads? Like one matched to each other, or is it just the four most?
The matching hadn't occurred yet for all of these galaxies, so at this point, it's just the most massive and the brightest. But this can be done with the matching, and I mean,
so I shouldn't look at like the bottommost match curve and the bottommost top curve.
No. And don't. I mean, so what will happen is the normalization of these will probably change, but the slope won't. Right. That's my point. Is that in the dark matter only run, no matter what mass you are, you've got a comparable slope, the cuspy. Right, so the slope will stay the same, but the normalization might change if I use different dark matter films.
Again, just to be clear, the ones on the left here are now, these are the 10 to the 5-ish stellar mass ones, and those are 10 to the 8-ish mm-hmm. stellar mass.
Yeah.
So the runs that you have, how many satellites of 10 to the 8-ish end up in the Milky Way, or in the halo that you have?
Well, there's two halos.
Right.
Two, maybe three total in the 10 to the 8 range.
So
all the rest are
you have a bunch of these ones that are still cuspy, and a couple of the more massive ones, like the Magellanic Clouds are above you.
So let me just understand. There is still a problem for the classical satellites.
The dwarf spheroidal. It's not for the Magellanic or regular galaxy.
The things in between the SMC and the ultra faint, there is still a problem.
Yeah.
What's the problem?
I don't really see that it's a problem. Because the VC ranges of the lower mass things, I mean, it just spans. You know, it's totally stochastic. I don't.
Well, the problem is
VC has to talk about data. This is what it is, right? VC performance.
Yeah.
The data tells you what it is.
You make arguments based on abundances.
Yeah, okay.
And those rely on being able to relate things on scale that you can see to counting halos.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
I'm just trying to understand.
Okay, the problem you're referring to is the Mikan table.
Yeah.
Okay. Were you just making a luminosity statement that the classical dwarfs have luminosities like those on the left hand
yes.
side of this panel?
What's the maximum luminosity of a classical dwarf?
So there's one classical dwarf that's 10 to the 7, and all the rest...
No, luminosities. I have MV values for these.
So you can touch
luminosity.
10 to the 7.
10 to the 7.
Yeah.
10 to the 7.
Okay.
The most are 10 to the 5 and 10 to the 6.
Oh, MV is minus 13.
Thank you. The range of these satellites is minus 9 to minus 13.
So that's... Yeah.
It's fine. It's totally in the luminosity range of the classical dwarf spheroidals.
Yeah,
so in Fornax and Sagittarius, obviously Magellanic Cloud is brighter.
Right.
But Fornax is minus 13.
Minus 12.5, 13, something like that.
So
I mean, that only must be comparable. Everything else is fainted by minus 12-ish, minus 11.
So in my mind, these halos are not likely not Milky Way mass, and I realize that that doesn't directly address the problem that you raised, right? But I, given this, I don't necessarily see that there's a problem in the Milky Way data. It's how I do.
I'm just confused because you said the ones on the left are 10 to the 5 stellar mass, and that is 10 to the, or that's minus 8.
A few times 10 to the 5.
Yeah, okay, so a few times 10 to the 5 is minus 8.5, minus 9, right?
Yeah, minus 9, yeah. Minus 9,
left.
Yep.
But that's ones that are still cuspy. The ones on the right are the ones that are brighter than that, right?
Okay.
So those are minus 13 and brighter.
Okay.
And those are the ones.
I took from your plots like that. I guess you would say all of them then are problematic.
Well, so the Magellanic.
You're saying
the Magellanic stuff. It makes sense that there's cores in those, and the other ones it doesn't seem like there would be.
There are, because only one of those, as I said, is a Magellanic. I can take one of these off the plot.
That's what I'm saying. Is I don't understand the numbers that you're quoting to me for the ones on the left, though. On the next plot that you showed.
Why?
In the Milky Way, there are eight of the classical dwarfs are below minus 13, which is, or most of them are 10 to the 5 to 10 to the 6, which I thought you, in stellar mass, which I thought you said is on the left-hand
side. Okay, so,
here's
what I took when I read your paper, right, is that some of these still could be fit, and that it was sort of a couple of points that the most massive ones that were more of a problem. I did not get that it was the entire range of dwarf spheroidals, but you're telling me that it's the entire range of classical dwarf spheroidals.
Yeah, because
it's inconsistent.
The half light.
And then I don't know if I believe that because I think it depended on how you cut it and to fit the. Okay, we should talk about this later because I need plots in front of me to figure this out.
Can I erase something real quickly? I might not be hearing the issue. Fornax has a circular velocity of 20 kilometers per second. Yeah, period. I'm sure Zena. the problem is, the decay problem is that there is dozens of subhalos larger than that appear to not have any stars. Right? Okay. So I'm buying that you can fit.
So what
if one can find a Fornax, one can make a Fornax somehow, some way in a simulation. But the problem is when you do that, you have an explosion of many more satellites in the models that should be observed, that are not observed. So how do you address this?
You make them dark?
Yeah. In my mind, you do this. But you're saying you're just never going to believe this because this isn't the Milky Way mass galaxy.
Well, that's one issue, yeah.
It can't be far off, right? You said
it's 8
times
10 to the
11.
Yeah.
That's what
it'll be. Because it changes the upper mass of the satellites by a factor of a few as well, right? So, okay.
Does the LMC have a core?
Yeah, we didn't have enough data points in the inner part to say, but based on a couple of slides ago, so even if it didn't, it's undergoing a merger with SMC, maybe. I mean, it's not a clean system, right? Because she was showing that one point which was really off from where you'd expect cores to be, and that could be because that system is in a merger. So.
It's really hard to fit it with a standard NFW. I mean, it has to be really low density NFW, so I think it would be entirely consistent with what Alex is saying.
Isn't it strongly baryon dominated in the center?
Yeah, so you have to put it like a concentration of 3 or something, you know, if you want to fit it with an NFW.
No. You can fit it. I mean, you have about as many baryons as you have dark matter. Wait, we're talking about?
But the innermost point I had was quite low, but it also had, you know, four.
Yes, right.
It looked like it could be a core, but it's just one point.
Right.
Yeah. Hopefully, it'll give us more time.
But we don't think that the LMC and the SMC have already, interacted, right?
We do.
Oh, you do? Okay.
I mean, that might not be true.
Okay.
All right. I'm like halfway through my talking right now.
Keep going.
Okay, so I was asked about the stellar disk. Okay. So this is the part that I'm actually more excited about. Dark matter is collisionless. So is stars, right? So the same thing that's operating on the dark matter when it expands the orbits is operating on the stellar orbits as well. Okay, so what you're seeing here are two different mass galaxies, so, you know, 4 times 10 to the 10 and about an order of magnitude larger. And what I've plotted here is the mean formation radius of stars that formed in different time bins. So basically the purple points formed in the first year and 2 gigayears after the Big Bang, and then bins of 4 gigayears following, okay? So the red stuff is the youngest. And in both cases, you can see that there's inside-out growth of the disk. But then I plotted the formation radius against the mean radius where they end up, and you can see that this dwarf galaxy gets completely reshuffled, basically, because of the dark matter formation. And if you go to this more massive galaxy, again within about a kiloparsec, you do see this happening. But in general, as you then, you know, things that form later and further on the disk, they aren't being affected by core creation at the center. And so they basically stay where they formed. What? Yeah, I understand. What?
Sorry, I'm just trying to think about observations.
Okay, so I have a couple of observations that I think can test this. The first is the size luminosity relationship. So bear with me here. The dark points are all observational data. This is the exponential scale length of galaxies versus their magnitude in the B band. And what you can see in red are the simulations. This is all at redshift zero, which I was really quite pleased with how well they fit the scatter and the trend in the size of luminosity relationship. So I had published this stuff previously, but now we've got a whole sample of dwarfs to add to it.
Before you start,
yep.
I just wonder always in simulations how much circular argumentation is in them, right? Because there's many subgrid physics things you have to set, and historically, like you said, there are these numbers which have been set in order to match certain observables, right? I mean, overcooling used to be a problem, right? You could set something else, you might make them a little bit bigger. I mean, how much of this is really sort of like not circular? Like matching the size for a given stellar mass or luminosity just because I happen to set this star formation efficiency parameter in a way that historically made sure my galaxy didn't look like a small ball or an incredibly large diffuse thing.
Sure. So. Sure. And it's true. So all of the parameters in these simulations are generally set to match, first of all, the Tully-Fisher relationship, which now I say is probably useless, right? But in the past, simulations didn't match the Tully-Fisher relationship, right? So that and now the M-star and halo relationship are the two big tests. So you're trying to get, and you want to match Tankit-Schmidt law as well. So basically, there are a couple of very big things that you're trying to match, and then what you hope falls out of it is that not only do you match the Tully-Fisher relationship, but you match the sizes of galaxies as well.
Right, but if you sort of look at these relations that you put in and sort of transform.
I don't put any of these relations in, right? All I'm tuning is star formation efficiency and a feedback parameter and seeing what I get out. And wanting them to land, tuning those to land basically on the Tankit-Schmidt law and the Tully-Fisher relationship.
You mentioned earlier, for example, the NH minus one in log was set to get the sizes approximately right. I think that's why there is a bit confused.
Oh. Right, okay. So, but that is not how these were set. That's not how these parameters are set. They were not tuned by size, okay? And if they were, they were tuned up here, okay? So historically, they were tuned up here. They were trying to make a Milky Way, okay? It doesn't mean that this stuff has to work. In no way.
The ball of gas, right? I mean, you make them smaller or larger, right? I mean, you go over this density threshold or not, which is set observation by the Kennedy-Schmidt law, right? But if that ball is a certain size, right, then right stars will start to form because it goes over this density threshold, and therefore your stars will roughly right follow that ball of gas if star formation occurs. Mm-hmm. I'm never convinced that some of these matchings are not the result of a circular argument.
Okay. Fair enough.
I'm not saying it is.
But what I can tell you is that historically, there was a big fight. More than about 5 years ago, because simulators, someone who I work with started saying that you could match the Tully-Fisher relationship, and the point was you might get luminosity and velocity right to match the relationship, but that doesn't mean that you get size and luminosity and velocity and size to match simultaneously. You need all three to match, and they didn't, right? The galaxies didn't, and so the point is that there is now something. That they were. It's such an iterative process. Like I have a hard time saying it. So the first thing you want to do is match the Tully-Fisher relationship, right? And then there was the let's see if we can make a bulbous galaxy. Oh my gosh, we'll get dwarfs out of them. And let's see if we match the sizes too, right? I mean, it's really just you don't tune it to match, but once you get them to match, you want them to always match, right? So. Yeah.
I mean, the Tully Fisher thing must get you, I think it has to get you a lot of the way to this one, because if your sizes were crazy, then I don't think you could match the Tully Fisher.
Well, it depends whether you measure the velocity for the tank.
Yeah. So the reason the Tully Fisher relationship really doesn't work is that you can have lots and lots of cooling and too much star formation, but then that actually, you know, that because of adiabatic contraction, your velocity goes up, but then so does your luminosity, and so you just move right along that relationship.
And it goes down.
Yes.
Right. If you overcool, your size goes down.
Well, it depends on how you measure it, but
yeah.
I mean, another way to think of it, like the classical eigenmomentum problem, was that we had to try to understand why galaxies seem to have a small fraction of the universal baryon fraction in them, but larger than the average eigenmomentum, specific eigenmomentum. Mm-hmm. So you have to arrange to get rid of the right gas, and that's what these recipes seem to be doing. So. I mean, I kind of agree with Allison. This is telling you something. You're getting rid of the right gas. If you just got rid of gas in some other way, this would not come out right.
I had a question concerning the stars, because the effect of the dark matter on the stars. So basically, what's happening when you reshuffle the dark matter through feedbacks, then you reverse the inside-out formation, because at the end, you end up with the oldest star in the outskirts and the youngest star at the center. So,
well, not necessarily. So what I didn't show here was how much mass is actually reshuffled, and I don't have an answer for that. So it's not.
If you look at that,
yeah.
The new points end up.
Yeah. But there's not necessarily as much mass in these assertions here. So I have to do that, make that product correctly. But.
Oh, yeah. I mean, independently of how many stars you have, you have the young stars at the edge.
It'll flatten out your gradient.
Yes, which is what I'm trying to get at. So, all right. So what I'm trying to say is I think there are two observable tests, and I haven't even made it to the first one here, which is, okay, so people who worked on the size-luminosity relationship have argued that if you fit the trend at the more massive end, that there's a break, and that the dwarfs actually follow a different trend. Okay, and so just in case you can't see that, I'm guided. All right, so I think it could be because of core creation. It's right about this mass where you start completely reshuffling your entire disk, right? So I think there's a scale at which the disk scale length is comparable to the core size, and basically those galaxies get a kick, and you end up following a different trend. And Rachel has informed me that, in fact, if you do this analytically, I guess it breaks down right about here as well. So I think that's encouraging.
And that's also right where we define core.
That's convenient.
Some people find
quarks. Yeah. Dwarf galaxy is defined around minus 18.
Okay.
So also though, you just went down here to like the minus 14, minus 15.
Yes. Yeah. These are all field galaxies.
Yeah. But in the painter end, you say, of course, you're not going to get this reshuffle in the dark matter, which would mean you're not going to get this reshuffling in the stars.
Right.
So presumably, based on that box, you should see a third sequence.
That's true, and I can actually.
It's a point with the dwarfs. Where basically all these
processes start. Right, so this is a plot from Ryan's paper, which you've seen because you're also on it. but showing the metallicity trends in, so this is the, let me actually follow the flow of this talk, right, and show you what I would predict first at these in the field galaxies. And it's exactly what you're saying, Andrea. That lower mass galaxy has no chemical trend, and the galaxy about an order of magnitude higher, so it actually has a bulge, so that's what this is here, but then there's a gradient over about 0.3 to 0.4 dex over the entire disk. Okay. And so, you know, I was in Sydney about a month ago. They have a new instrument that they call SAMI, which is a multi-object IFU, and they want to do survey science with it. So I was there actually making the case for dwarf galaxies, because they claim they want to get chemical gradients in stars, right? So if you make this plot in gas, you don't see the same trends, right? It has to be the stars, because it's the stars that are being reshuffled. So, no, but I mean, but my, so the point then with Ryan's plot is that if you go to the only galaxies that have had spectroscopic metallicities, you're looking at it, right?
The stars?
For the stars.
Which have radiant gradients.
Well,
yeah,
especially.
I caught
none of that.
M31, we have a bunch of a bunch of stellar metallicities of function radius.
Right, okay. Satellites.
Oh, sorry, for the NGCs, yes.
Okay.
The NGCs.
Fair enough.
Those are comparable to what you M31 satellites.
Yeah, satellites. M31. So the point is, here are the satellites, here are the dwarf regulars. Okay. The dwarf regulars seem to show a much
shallower term. We should talk about
that first,
because I would say that the dwarf ellipticals have no radial gradients. Up to very large
radius.
Which data are you plotting for the
That's a tough definition for me.
Yeah, sorry. Something that's minus 15, so just slightly.
Yeah, right. I know, but the half light radius.
Out to 1 kiloparsec, and we go up to.
I don't resolve densities like that. The difference between a dwarf spherical and dwarf elliptical is kind of critical in terms of resolution, right? I don't resolve compact things like dwarf ellipticals.
So
No. These are minus 15 dwarf galaxies.
Okay.
Slightly more massive than what we would call dwarf spherules in the Milky Way.
And how far out did you say they extend the observations? Out to how many core radii?
10 core radii.
And they're flat.
Yeah.
Okay.
Which dwarf spheroidal data are you?
This is DART, right? So not everybody's on here. It's only. There's a cutoff. It's a selection of, so Evan's stuff isn't on here because it didn't extend out too far enough core radii to put on the spot.
Okay, because in Evan's data, half of the dwarf spherules are actually flat.
I know, but if they're also within core radii, then that's a problem.
So the x-axis along the bottom
is. Oh, sorry.
So, you know, I mean, a lot of that is much more in the central regions. So, I mean, these are just galaxies for which you get sort of very good spatial
sample. So I think we should talk after
that. Okay. But I actually, so this is old data. Actually, can I even? This is old data, but this is one of my old dwarf spherules. And you can see that basically the older stars, this is a really crappy plot, and it should just be like metallicity, average metallicity as a function radius. But what you see is the old stars are more metal poor and extend further, and the younger stars are more metal rich and are in the center, so they should have a metallicity gradient, like you said. Okay. I don't know. I'm going to wrap up. Huh?
I thought the young stars were on the outside, aren't you? Now they're on the inside.
Dwarf spheroidal, yeah, it's different. Yeah, it's different for the dwarf spheroidal versus the field galaxies, But maybe not for all of them. So, well, and it's not for all of them that we know of, right?
It's just a bit more massive, and so it actually supports your point.
Maybe, yeah, maybe. Well, that would be.
And if you have a merger, or even if you just interacted, tidally with something, then that could undo this, right?
Yeah.
Well, but all the ones that you were on there would be just as. Would have just as been affected just as much by environment.
You don't know what's happened to them in the past, though.
But you don't know for any of them.
Yeah.
Yeah. I definitely have dwarfs that pass through each other at some point. So it'd be interesting to see. Dwarf spheroidals that pass through each other and then end up inside the real radius of the main galaxy. So it'd be actually really interesting to see if that has a different chemical term. All right.
Do you have any more points for Quick?
Really quick, yeah. Okay.
We won't ask any questions.
Okay, right, okay. I was just going to make the case. I was going to invoke Nick, who apparently was all distrustful of H1 data that says that disk galaxies have cores. So, Josh, is this one of yours? Is this like a classic core to galaxy in H1? Adams et al. Went back and looked at it with Virus P and got stellar kinematics and found that, in fact, the stellar kinematics are more consistent with the NFW, but this sort of depends on how you treat the mass light rate to light ratio of the stellar population, so I wouldn't say it was an open shut case. However, might be NFW if you look at the stars. This is Ryan Lehman's data from a couple weeks ago, and I don't know if anybody noticed, but if you look at the mass enclosed using the stars and plot up either an isothermal sphere or NFW, like there's really no evidence necessarily that it's isothermal, but the gas, the H1 gas, is as well. So I think this is really interesting. This is actually only the only point I wanted to make here is there's a case of two galaxies where you can use stellar kinematics and you get a mass profile that's inconsistent with the gas. And so it would be really interesting to get more data points and try to figure out why that is. So that's why I was asking you about the LMC. SMC would be awesome too, but again, it's interacting.
Well, so we have data for 7 or 8 more galaxies now. We just haven't analyzed them.
Okay, cool. This is really not worth going into, actually. So there you go. So any questions?
So what would, presuming that there are some galaxies that have cusps, what would you predict to be different?
I don't know. So obviously I like the core thing, right? Because I like the fact that it gives you bulges galaxies with dark matter cores. I like the fact that it, you know, makes it might, and this is still obviously a huge debate, but it might make the satellites in the Milky Way less luminous. It might explain the size luminosity relationship if we can get more chemical gradient trends. And, you know, that's a big test of the model. I really like this because it's a nice, not only does it explain a whole bunch of observations, but it also makes some really nice predictions, right? But if it's wrong, it's wrong. You know, I'll just be honest. So
the model makes predictions for, you know, different star formation histories for galaxies that have cusps.
Oh, so you're saying, right, so, well, you know, in first order, it should just be mass.
Well, but you could imagine a galaxy that had a very quiescent star formation history.
But I'm thinking of, like, the things data that have been, that were plotted against the simulation data. I mean, presumably, their merging history is varied. And they all seem to sort of fill in that range.
Because the SIM's parent sample is sort of selected to be things that look nice, right? Like nice
disks.
So there's definitely selection going on here.
Rachel Clusio Denari sent her LSB data, and they also match that plot, that same plot as of cores as a function of mass. Again, that might.
Those are probably also preferentially undisturbed.
That's okay. That's one of the simulations, right?
So
are the simulations. So if we look at it as a function,
we should look at
a merger history or some other parameter, then yeah, we might get a direction.
So in terms of the star formation history and how it affects the mass distribution, I mean, clearly, what you need is basically, you keep saying that you need a really bursty star formation history. But like, I'm just wondering, so from an observer's point of view, is this kind of bursty world of scales which I'm going to be able to kind of resolve? Like, I mean, is there any sort of correlation between the star formation history of a galaxy and what one might expect in terms of the mass profile? So going back to Josh, you know, if you have a very quiescent thing,
right,
you know, it's just very, very low level star formation, presumably not much is going to happen.
It doesn't even, just smooth.
I'm just trying to get sort of a better feel of what do you really mean by first stage?
Well,
or is it a better way of quantifying something? Is it really just in more detail or what? I'm just trying to get a sense in terms of observation.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't even quantified it in the simulation yet, right? Yeah. So, I mean, you know, we're looking at the peaks to trough ratio or mean star formation rate and factor what above it, what, you know, can you quantify in the simulations that would give you, give you a well-defined prediction, and then I would...
Or like a dwarf galaxy which has all of its star formation in the first year versus
a dwarf
galaxy which has bursts of star formation over 12 gigayears.
Yeah.
So it would end up looking exactly the same direction.
So this is the problem, that most of these cores are forming, you know, well, in the field it's at redshifts greater than 1. For the satellites, it's like at redshifts greater than 3. So what kind of resolution do you have in the star formation history? Is that could even...
Everybody's exhausted.